911, what's your emergency?
My boss's wife tried to serve me collard greens, and she knows I'm on blood thinners.
Have you considered legal action?
I like it. Okay. I like that one because, like, it's... I don't want to say it's still not strong, but it's the strongest one that we chose from our lineup.
Okay, for the record, listeners, you be the judge. I had a joke where that Ryan shot down because he didn't think it was a joke, where it was going to be like, 911, what's your emergency? My boss just stabbed me in the back. And then the dispatcher's like, I'm sending an ambulance to you now. And then the caller is like, no, I meant figuratively. And, like, that's the joke. And I thought it was funny, but some people...
I don't think it's a... I feel like that's more of a statement, right? That's, like...
It's a bait and switch, you know? It's like a play on words, because stabbed in the back is a figure of speech. Nobody understands me.
I'm just, like, I'm a sucker for a punchline. Right. And so when
there is a punchline in mind, I really shouldn't complain because I like shoot you down all the time.
What's softer than a punch? It's like a tap line. Right. It's like, oh,
and subtlety can and restraint are stronger in comedy than exaggeration sometimes.
You keep saying subtlety and restraint, but I don't think this is like subtle or restrained. I think it's just like a blunt statement.
Wow. Well, we'll leave it up to the listeners.
I try not to shoot anything down because like I don't want to like be mean or anything, because like I have been told in the past I can come off as mean when I'm just trying to be direct, but
been told that. I've had all these people tell me they thought I was mean when they first met me, which is never the impression I intend to give.
Yeah, I feel like I've never known you to be mean at all. So, you're out here like I'm Ellen. I'm mean.
Well, welcome back to the First Respodcast, everybody. We are officially done with the tsunami arc, so we're into like the meat of season three. And yes. Today's episode is season three, episode four, Triggers. I wonder if that theme will be brought up in a very literal way throughout the episode.
If the show is a little more right wing, they probably would have called this episode like Trigger Warning and like made it kind of like, you know, haha,
hashtag
fuck you
triggered.
For having trauma. Hashtag snowflakes.
This episode was directed by Joaquin Cedillo, who is a prolific director of photography for the series and directed a few more episodes after this, including the Buck Coma Dream episode from season six, which kind of makes sense to me that it was directed by a cinematographer, because I do remember that episode being like full of weirdly placed Dutch angles and stuff. Like it tries to be really... technically interesting, maybe to make up for the lack of depth in the screenplay.
But this
episode was written by David Fury, who also wrote the previous episode, and two other writers. It was written by David Fury, Christopher Monfette, who did Bobby Begins Again, and also Eddie Begins, womp womp, and also Tanya Kong, who also wrote season three, episode eight, Malfunction, and those are the only episodes she's written.
I don't remember anything about season three, episode eight. I'm going to be so honest with you. So I don't know if Tanya Kong.
Yeah, but we'll get there. I think it might be one of those, like, kind of, I don't want to say filler, because I don't think that's an accurate word for those episodes, but like episodes that are just like 911 call episodes versus like really like memorable like event episodes or whatever. I kind of like that type of episode personally.
The normal sort of like mid-season episode, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Okay, I know what you mean. Yeah, just like the episode that's like, oh, this is the premise of the show. It's like a quintessential episode of 911 because it's about the calls.
Yeah. That one. Oh, it's the one with the ice skating accident where we learn Bobby used to be a figure skater. See, that's a good one.
Yeah, see, that is a good episode, actually. Is that the Christmas episode?
No.
No, it's not.
It says it also involves Eddie's Fight Club storyline, so that'll be interesting.
Oh, wow. Can't wait to delve into that storyline with you.
But anyway, I thought at the top of this episode, like, as much as the tsunami arc was great, it is kind of nice to be back in classic 911 call format territory. Like, this is the real, like I just said, I like that kind of episode where we're just getting a lot of 911 calls.
Yeah, me too. And the calls this episode were pretty good overall. I especially love one towards the end that we'll talk about as one of my my like so so there's this like overarching, like we'll get into it, there's this overarching theme of like siblings and sort of like the sibling dynamics and like the lessons you learn from your siblings and everything and how they shape you into the person that you become. And we see it all through the eyes of Hen. And so I just like that every call riffs on that idea in a unique way.
Yeah. As much as this is an episode about triggers, it's also a sibling theme episode.
And as someone with a sibling, I greatly enjoyed it. Because it's specifically like sibling pairs. It's like, it's specifically like two kid families, like the nuclear family archetype kind
of. Damn, I have two siblings, so I guess this episode is not for me.
Hashtag unrelatable for Jane. Hashtag less of a person. Just kidding. I'm just kidding. I don't know where that came from. I was so out of pocket.
but we begin less of a person. I'm always saying that.
but we begin on a cold open. Fire trucks are racing through the streets of downtown LA. The 118 is responding to what appears to be a building fire. They step out. Chimney says, "Man, that's the biggest fire I've ever seen." Then the camera pulls back up the height of the building to reveal it's a drill. It's a mock fire drill.
Is he stupid?
That idiot.
Chimney, there is no fire.
That's the biggest fire he's ever seen. Wow, he must not have been doing this job for very long.
What a dumbass. Anyway, they are actually doing a fire drill, and we hear that they're 4 minutes over their allotted response time, so that's no good. And somebody says, someone's gonna have to explain that to the new fire marshal, and they all kind of look over at Bobby. Cut to, it's clipboard Buck. Someone has given Buck a clipboard, and he's gone mad with power. This is his light duty that we heard about in the opening episode. He has become fire marshal. He's like in a little button-up shirt, and he has decided to, you know, kind of protest this by being the pettiest, bitchiest little fire marshal to the 118 specifically. I loved this for him. I think he's earned it. It's kind of like when we were talking about in the first episode of the season, how Buck was really going through it and it felt like none of his peers were really taking him seriously. In that vein, I kind of feel like he's earned the opportunity to just like be a real bitch to them in this episode.
No, I fully agree. Like, this was a long time coming, especially like with everything that's going on now. And also, I will say, I don't know much about like the institution of like a fire department, but isn't fire marshal like a pretty big deal of a job? Like, that's kind of, it's like a really important administrative job, right? I'm pretty sure
it sounds like it is.
It definitely sounds official, you know. it's one of those big job sounding titles. I will say one little funny production thing I noticed here right off the top is that Eddie says, and I don't know if this is true. Again, no idea how fire departments work. I don't know if this is true, but Eddie says that the city makes them do these every 3 years, which is a fun little in-universe explanation for why they didn't do one last season or the season before that.
I guess. And yeah, that's funny.
It reminds me of in season 2 of Glee, because it all comes back to Glee, when they're doing like the rumors episode and they bring back the Muckraker. And then Terry says to Sue, but McKinley disbanded the Muckraker 2 years ago due to lack of interest. And it's like, oh, that's why we haven't heard of it before. And we're in like a later season of the show.
Genius television writing. It's funny, though, because they didn't really have to do that, because like we could have just assumed that it happened off screen in the last season or whatever. And it's not like we ever see them doing a drill again in the show. And it's been more than 3 years, but whatever.
It's just one of those funny little things. That's like such like a TV writer moment of like just like sidestepping like a potential like YouTube like let me point out a continuity error, plot hole ding, like in the dialogue.
Yeah.
And so I always like to look out for those because I think they're funny. But yes, Clipboard Buck is terrorizing the 118. He is, you know, hounding like every little tiny detail, like sort of nitpicking every little, all of their timing, every thing they're doing wrong. And Bobby, like, he's kind of taking it in stride. He, you know, says to Buck, you know, that he's glad he didn't throw away his career after everything that happened, because, you know, Buck tried to quit.
Yeah, he explains to Bobby that if he's going to do this kind of light duty, he's got to do it by the book, which, again, just like fully throwing it back in Bobby's face, which I kind of loved. I was like, yeah, you know, get him for me, Buck. I like this.
And there was a touch of sincerity in this interaction. You know, he mentions that the tsunami reminded him of like why he does this, and you know, he doesn't give up.
He's not a quitter.
He's a fighter. Yeah, because if he was a quitter, that sweet little Christopher would have been dead as
lost
disco.
At sea.
Lost at sea. Okay, so he says something like at the end of this scene that's like one of those like things that you hear it and it's like, I don't think I've ever heard a sentence like that before. He says, Bobby's going off back to work, right? And Buck yells after him, be careful not to log jam at the stairwells. And I was watching, I'm like, what does that mean?
Okay, let me look up the word log jam. A crowded mass of logs blocking a river, or a situation that seems irresolvable. Okay, so assuming it probably just means a blockage, a jam.
Right. Try not to turn the stairwell into like a choke point or whatever. Okay.
Which, ironically, then we cut to a bunch of people evacuating down the stairwell of this building, and we see one guy in particular. He kind of looks like he's maybe getting afraid of heights. He, like, looks down the stairwell. He puts some sunglasses on. He seems a little disoriented. So he looks like he's getting afraid of heights or maybe vertigo, but then suddenly he starts having a seizure and kind of falls over, and this causes this whole domino effect of everybody falls down the stairs.
Incredible.
And, you know, back on the ground, you see the 118 watching this, and you see Buck make like a really dramatic show of like making a note on his clipboard, like, ooh, this isn't going well.
He's such a goddamn brat. Oh my god. This the like, I love that Oliver.
Somebody tame this brat. Sorry. Who said that?
I love that Oliver chose violence in his performance today, because he said, I'm going to make Buck the brattiest, bitchiest little boss I possibly can. So sassy. Obsessed with this.
Clipboard. Buck, whenever he gets a clipboard, is like, I am going to create an environment that is so toxic.
So toxic.
But we find out they're like wheeling the guy out on a stretcher, and we find out that he had an epileptic seizure. So like looking back on it, you can see the fire alarms were going off. So there were like flashing lights. There were all these sounds. There were like a lot of people. So those types of things can trigger a seizure. And suddenly an ambulance chaser shows up, which is, of course, like one of those lawyers who tries to exploit people who have been in accidents to sue whoever they can. And this ambulance chaser's name is literally Chase. I thought that was the funniest fucking detail, that they were writing this one like, oh my god, we've got to name the ambulance chaser Chase.
Yeah, this was written by three people, and I just hope they were all like nudging each other in the ribs whenever they
wrote
down the guy's
name. That's what
name.
I was imagining. Yeah, he like gives the guy his card.
This is like the prototypical like blood sucking lawyer. He's like the it's like the media vultures that like hound a celebrity coming out of a funeral. And so he's already offering him representation. He's like, this building doesn't seem like it was in compliance with this disability act.
And I think it's Hen says to him, like, maybe wait till he's actually in the ambulance to start chasing it.
So good. So good. And Clipboard Buck. Okay, here's the thing. Whenever Clipboard Buck was on screen, I didn't write down what he was doing. I just wrote down in all caps, Clipboard Buck.
Well, I don't have any more notes about Clipboard Buck in this scene specifically, so I don't think he did anything notable.
I'm just presuming that he was sassy, and that's it.
Probably. But we cut to the Grant household, where Hen and Karen and Denny are over at Athena's house, and we see Denny and Harry are fighting over a video game. And, you know, Hen's trying to break it up. Denny's really not wanting to share. And then at the table, Hen and Karen are talking to Athena about the IVF they're doing. And because of this little conflict between Denny and Harry, they start talking about the whole sibling thing. And like, is Denny ready to have a sibling? Does he want to have a sibling? That's something they haven't really considered before. Athena does this thing where she gets them to stop fighting by just yelling kids. And like, she's one of those like
so
scary
perfectly.
Moms that like she can just yell that and they stop immediately.
This is one of those like survival skills as a parent you develop when you have like when the kids start to outnumber you, you know, and so it's like, you know, there's like a bear and you have to make yourself bigger and make loud noises in order to scare it off. I was obsessed with that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but the boys are fighting. Athena handles it, and Karen, like, she is like firmly on the side of like you know, kids having siblings, right? Because she had brothers. And Hen and Athena are only children, right? And so
yeah,
Karen,
which there's a great line where Hen says both Athena and I were only children and we turned out just fine. And I was listening to this like, okay, yes, they are amazing women, and also mm-hmm. I can kind of tell that they were only children.
Yeah.
They both have kind of main character energy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like, I don't want to use any like derogatory terms about it, because like, you know, there's nothing wrong with like having like main character energy, but like I feel like having a sibling humbles you in a sense, because it's like
it does.
you're kind of always in it together with someone else, you know, you're always mm-hmm. kind of sharing the spotlight, and so you never really have an opportunity to feel,
and
like
you have somebody to be mean to you all the time.
Oh yeah. And so you never really have the opportunity to be like me, you know.
I feel like, yeah, Hen and Athena, they're great, but sometimes the way, like, they're both so dramatic and have their ways of sort of like pushing people away and dealing with things by themselves. Like, I can kind of tell they were only children. That's kind of good characterization.
Mm-hmm.
And Hen suddenly gets worried that Denny might not like having a sibling, but, you know, Karen is saying, like, I mean, I think the main sentiment is like, he'll get over it. Like, you know, of course kids don't think they'll want a sibling.
Well, Athena says something interesting, which is that May mm-hmm. loved having a baby brother. She loved having a baby brother until he got big enough to start like snooping through her stuff and like having a personality and getting all up in her business. And that was so I felt that so hard, because like I was the baby brother. And so my mom would always tell this story of the day that they brought me home from the hospital. They're spending so much time looking after me, and my sister goes, "I want to go back to being a one kid family." And my mom looks at her and goes, "Oh, but honey, what would we do without you?"
Damn. Wow. That was kind of uncalled for on both of their parts.
My sister, she goes like, "That's not what I meant." And she like stormed off. And so like, that became like a recurring joke in our family. So like, I totally like bought everything about this whole setup here. I totally like believed May about that.
Athena and Karen kind of drive home that like, you know, even if Denny's not ready for this in the moment, he will adjust. And, you know, that's how having a sibling works. But, you know, we see Hen developing a little anxiety about this, which will be a theme throughout the episode.
Yes. Speaking of themes throughout the episode, we go from that to Chim and Maddie having a little breakfast. I want to say they have glasses of milk.
I wasn't sure what meal it was.
They have glasses of milk and like a croissant, and okay. So I'm assuming it's like breakfast at Chim's, breakfast uh-huh. at Chimney's. That would be
my favorite Capote play.
My favorite Audrey Hepburn movie. Yes. So they're having breakfast at Chimney's, and they're like, you know, talking about the mock call, Buck's a monster. Maddie reminds Chimney that, you know, there's a fair amount of the pot calling the kettle black. Flashback to a clipboard Chimney.
Yeah, Captain
I love
Chimney.
That this show always, whenever like they put like one of like the subordinates in a position of power, they always go mad with power right off the bat, except for Hen, which is why Hen should have been captain in season 8.
Yeah, you guys, we forgot to mention this in our season 8 finale bonus episode, but yes, we also think it's, you know, Captain Chimney is like fine. Like, I get that he mm-hmm. may have grown since season 2 in terms of being captain, but like, what was the reason to not make Hen captain? It feels so weird that they just sort of made up these lame excuses that she wouldn't want it all of a sudden.
It's like retreading that like whole thing where like Athena was like going to be promoted to sergeant. She was going to be promoted to like captain and then didn't want to because she was happy with her life and her career. And it's like, why are you stopping black women from like, you know, ascending the
leadership
ranks?
Leadership positions. Exactly. Yeah. At this point, it kind of just feels like they refuse to have a woman captain. It's like, like, what's going on here?
Yeah, especially given the news about 911 Nashville. Soon to be the greatest show in the history of television, I'm sure.
Soon to be 911 Flopville. Am I right? Got him.
No, you're right. It's like you tweeted about this, but like just the whole casting call and like the character sheets they're putting out are making it seem like this is gonna be a very like a show about like pure Aryan bloodlines. Like it's like white. It's like, what are we doing here? Okay.
Sorry to go on a tangent, guys, but you know us. The latest tea about 911 Nashville is there was like some kind of either casting call or like character breakdown leaked of these two characters that they're just like two younger men on the fire team, whatever you call that, and there's no indication that they will have a romantic relationship, but everybody is assuming that they will because one of them is named Ryan and one of them is named Blue, and everybody's like, is this knockoff Buddy? Is this just knockoff? Which I think it'd be hilarious if it turns out these guys are like brothers or something.
wouldn't that be the ultimate slap in the face,
which hey, hasn't stopped Ryan Guzman.
Oh my god.
But I think at the same time it would also be really funny if this also was just a buddy knockoff, because I'm not saying that the gay guys on Lone Star were a buddy knockoff, but it does seem like it was maybe the idea to have like a central gay couple was a little bit inspired by the buddy fandom, mm-hmm. like being so into 911. And it'd be, just be really funny if they did that a third time.
I'm so confused by like why they're, you know, going in so hard on this. It's like Tim Minear like looked into the camera and said, "Y'all mind if a white boy speak with a little country twang?" Y'all mind if a white boy sing a little Shania Twain? You know, like what are we doing here? You know, so I'm confused by like this show's like raison d'être, basically. Like what's the motivation? What's the inspiration? Going into this project. I think we're all kind of confused.
For Tim Minear to leave OG 911, that would be my my preferred raison d'etre for Nashville.
I support that journey. I do.
Bargain bin buddy aside, back in season 3, yes, mm-hmm. Maddie and Chimney are having this little exchange, and suddenly Maddie accidentally drops a plate and it shatters. Mm-hmm. And she is very triggered in this moment, mm-hmm. you could say. Remember, this episode is called Triggers. And
she's getting a flashback.
She mm-hmm. kind of, you know, she was in this abusive marriage. She kind of freaks out. And, you know, Chimney comes up to, you know, be like, are you okay? And she, you know, is feeling triggered by being in this situation. So she kind of really hastily makes an excuse and leaves. And Chimney can see what happened, but like mm-hmm. didn't really get a chance to do anything about it. So we go to the 118 and he is describing this to Eddie. Eddie is just fucking yawning, big as fuck. Like, Chimney is telling him this really serious thing, and Eddie's just like, seemingly not listening at all.
It was really hard,
I was just like, damn, this is hilarious. Like, Chimney did this, and he's like, never telling Eddie about my life again.
And we find out that the reason he's tie-tie is because Chris is having nightmares. Ever since the tsunami.
Yes, so he does have a valid reason to be tired, but it's a very funny juxtaposition.
He's been waking up screaming, and Eddie has to, you know, go and comfort him until he falls back asleep. Sleep, and it's been kind of this never-ending cycle of Chris he's traumatized from the tsunami mm-hmm. and potentially some other stuff, which we'll get into, and so he's just like having this moment, and Eddie's just getting kind of overwhelmed. But before they can really dwell on that, guess who should show up but Hall Monitor Buck. Is in the building.
Hall Monitor Buck is here. Uh-huh. He is like negging the fire station. He's like, did you guys paint? This place looks smaller. And Chimney's like, I think your head just got bigger.
Mm-hmm. And turns out Buck reveals that the 118 passed their exam because Buck fudged the numbers. make them pass, which is sweet. He's doing something for them. It is sweet.
He says, I bumped up the numbers, got fancy with the math. Eddie says, you don't know math.
And Buck's like, that's gonna be my excuse if anyone catches me. Right. Thank you.
Right. I feel like there are two ways you could read this, which is one, Buck actually doesn't know math and it's true that he's just, you know, kind of making it up as he goes along, or that maybe Buck does know math and it's like he's just kind of, nobody knows that. Nobody would assume that from his exterior. But then in season 6, there's the time when he gets struck by lightning and gains magical math powers.
Well, I mean, like, I think there's also, like, a third, like option, which is, like, there might be a little truth to it that, like, Buck doesn't have the greatest book smarts in the world. And so Eddie's doing that, like, friendly negging thing where, you know, Buck's like, I'll drive. Eddie's like, you can't drive. Or, like, something like that. Like, you know, right. Like, one of those little, like, friendly nudges of, like, yeah, you're bad at this. Let me make fun of you for it, that you do with your friends sometimes.
Of course.
But it's sweet. And someone mentions the lawyer. There's a lawsuit happening.
Well, Buck mentions that the lawyer actually contacted him to try and get him to kind of squeal on the situation. Mm-hmm.
Then the camera pans over and Lena Bosco is in the building. She says, Diaz, can you come help me with this? Can you come spot me? Because she's lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Buck immediately gets jealous.
Immediately gets jealous. He's like, oh,
he's
what?
He's like, who
you
is that?
You replaced me? You replaced me as Eddie's, you know, number one, you know, spot subject already.
Eddie's got a new work wife. Sorry, Buck.
And Bobby reveals, no, that's Bosco. Her station got flooded. They all had to be temporarily reassigned. She was really helpful with us, so we invited
her. Bobby's like, you're
here.
Not being replaced. Buck's like, then what's that over there? And we cut to this hilarious shot of Buck's, like, locker with his last name on it. Somebody has taped over the last part of Buckley, so and written on a piece of tape, Bosco.
But they kept the B. Oh my
god.
If I was
brutal.
Buck,
absolutely
I
brutal.
Would have murdered someone. Like, I would have, like, the station would have been full of bodies. Like, someone really needs to give Buck a gun at this point with the amount that people are, like, pushing him.
It's what he deserves, but I think that we're lucky that nobody gave him a gun during this stage of the story.
Well, but also, I mean, you know, Buck is much more likely to shoot himself than someone else. That's just a fact.
All right. Well, but Bobby says to Buck that Buck's place will still be here for him when he's ready. And I thought, like, at least he's finally communicating that, because I feel like that was kind of the problem prior to this, is that nobody seems to be able to communicate to Buck, like, no, you can have your job back eventually. Like, we just need you to be patient. It seemed like there was this question of, like, Buck seemed to be under the impression that it's, like, all or nothing. Like, he either gets to go back to work immediately or he never will. So I was glad that Bobby was at least finally saying, like, no, your place will still be here. You just need to wait a little longer.
Well, I feel like he could have done better to articulate that. I don't want to, like, baby Buck in this moment, because, like, it is, like, I don't like how people, like, infantilize him on some level, because, like,
I think this is the storyline where he's the most, like, wronged, and you could do that the most.
I agree. Like, on the one hand, yes, he's an adult man who is, like, fully capable of asking questions and, like, learning more about a situation before he acts. But at the same time, it's like, Bobby could have done better to articulate that. No, Buck, we're just waiting for you to recover and actually heal and get back to your medical 100%. So that your job will be waiting for you when it's good and done. Right.
Mm-hmm. Before Buck leaves, he rips the Bosco sign off of his name.
Very dramatically. It's a very dramatic beat of, like, this is the maybe the real proper start of Buck's dominoes falling, as it were.
Yeah.
We saw human dominoes earlier in the episode, and this is an internal domino moment for Buck.
Oh yeah, very, very deep, very profound. Mm-hmm. This is a great episode for dramatic Buck. For drama queen Buck.
No, I agree. That's the best way to put it, is drama queen Buck, because all of his drama is so, like, it's not juvenile. It's like it's emotionally, like, true and real in the way that, like teenage heartbreak is emotionally true and real. Do you know what I mean?
He's kind of histrionic about it.
Yeah.
In a beautiful and lovable way.
I agree.
We cut to Eddie waking up in the night. that night to Chris having a nightmare. He's like yelling out for him. So Eddie rushes into his room, like comforts Christopher. Christopher says something about she was drowning. It's like, what could that mean? I guess it's what he's been dreaming about. Cut to Eddie.
Yeah, takes Chris to a child psychiatrist. We find out Chris has been going to therapy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's not really opening up in terms of, like, actually verbalizing what's going on in his head. Probably because he isn't actually properly, like, processing it. It's still in his subconscious. But he is, mm-hmm. you know, drawing pictures. You know, the classic child psychiatrist tactic of getting them to draw pictures. Mm-hmm. And in these pictures, he's drawing not just the tsunami. Not just this, can I just say, Chris is a much better artist than I was at his age, or possibly have ever been.
So he's good.
Good for Chris. He's got a career ahead of him. But a mainstay in his art is this idea of a drowning woman in the tsunami.
This is a good episode for everybody's like drama queen sensibilities to come out. I'm not saying a child having nightmares and drawing them is drama queen, but there's just something so like storytelling dramatic about this, like sort of like gothic fiction about like Christopher having these dreams of a woman drowning and then drawing them out for his father to see. I don't know. I just love like the drama of everyone in this storyline.
It reminds me of like a creepypasta or like those like Reddit horror stories of like, hi, I'm a suburban mom. My child has been drawing some really disturbing things and his teacher
my
can't
get
it.
My child keeps drawing this man with no face and he tells me he's called the no face man. Is this normal?
In every picture, there's a man standing by the sidewalk with a car and a little girl with a knife in the window above the attic. Oh, it's so scary.
And every time he draws it, the little girl with the knife gets closer and closer to our house.
It's like
creepy pastas are so funny.
They're so funny. I love them. They're like comfort media for me. he's fixated on this one particular drowning woman. Eddie's kind of at a loss because Buck seemingly never mentioned a drowning woman. They didn't come across any, you know, all the people they came across for the most part, Buck saved and he tried to shield Chris from most of it. But then he's like rationalizing. He's like, well, they were separated for a long time. Who knows what Chris saw mm-hmm. out there? And so he asks the psychiatrist, you know, is there anything I can do for him in the meantime? And he says, just keep loving him.
Just keep loving that kid.
And that's sweet.
Yeah.
That's sweet, isn't it?
It is.
That sort of bookends that. And we go to Maddie at work. And she's getting one of those silent calls. You know, she's like, hello, 911. No one's there. 911, are you okay? And then turns out it's a woman in a crisis, seemingly a domestic crisis. Mm-hmm. She can't really get a lot of information about the woman before her seemingly violent, abusive husband interrupts the call, and the woman hangs up very abruptly. It's like, sorry, you have the wrong number, hangs up.
Right. And Maddie goes back into like the call logs and sees mm-hmm. that this person has a history of terminated 911 calls. So, of course, the only conclusion she can draw is that this must be a domestic violence situation. She calls back, like, pretending to be... She calls back and a man answers the phone. So she kind of just quickly pretends to be a cleaning service. She's like, did you know that for as little as $49.99 a month? And, you know, the guy is like, don't call us again. Like, take us off your list.
I will say, I do have, like, a little bit of confusion over, like, caller ID with, like, 911, like, dispatch. Like when you get a call from, like, a dispatch center that's, like, hooked into, like, the main line or whatever, does it just come up as 911 on your phone? I don't know. I've never had that experience, I don't know.
And I would think maybe for safety reasons, maybe they have a way to mask themselves.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. she talks to Josh about it. And Josh is like, maybe we could do a welfare check. But Maddie's mm-hmm. like, no. Like, I've been in this situation. That would only make it worse. And then she mm-hmm. says, I know that you think this is triggering something personal for me. The title of the episode is Triggers. Mm-hmm. And Josh is like, I get it. Like, you know, I wish I knew what the magic words were. But we can't really help someone, you know, other than doing a welfare check. There's not much we can do right now. He says maybe the magic words don't work over the phone, which gives Maddie a little idea. Maddie is entering her kind of unhinged arc, which I love for her. Again, dramatic. Like, this is her dramatic arc.
I do too. I love this for her. I will say, Josh was really like unintentionally setting her up for that, and like it was like it's such like a moment of like, Josh, I mean, listen, you had to know you were planting an idea in her head, right? Like,
well, I mean, who could have, in defense of Josh, who could have predicted that she would have started stalking this lady?
The viewers at home, of course.
The viewers at home who have already watched the show like 3 times through. Yes, we could have predicted that.
Yes, exactly. Oh, hindsight. What a wonderful drug. It's so good.
But we cut to Buck meeting with Chase, the ambulance chaser, who, you know, wanted to ask him some more questions about what happened. And he brings up that it's a class action lawsuit against the mm-hmm. city. And Buck mm-hmm. is immediately very defensive of the city and the fire department. This turns into like city employee propaganda, which I love, because I think I've said before, like, what we don't need is more propaganda. What we do need is more propaganda for these like underfunded like city and state employees. So he's like, you know, those city employees are just doing their jobs and they're mm-hmm. heroes. I was just loving this. Like, my mom works for the state. I was like, yes, like random government employee. And, you know, they're right now, like, our government is trying to defund and like get rid of mm-hmm. like actually very important kind of cogs in the machines of mm-hmm. government. And like, these things are important. So Buck starts being very defensive of the fire department.
We should we should sit Trump down and show him this scene is what you're saying. Elon Musk, we're going to strap him to a chair and be like, watch and learn.
The cast of Hamilton should come to Congress and sing History Has Its Eyes on You. And that would teach him. But anyway, Chase mentions, he says, I find disgruntled employees make the best witnesses. And he mentions that he like did a little research about Buck and he knows about his situation with his injury and stuff. And this really triggers Buck, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because Buck gets more angry after this because, you know, he's touched a nerve.
It becomes like really clear that this guy is like recruiting Buck for his class action lawsuit. And Buck very like instinctively goes, that's my family. Don't try to turn me against my family, bro. That's not cool.
And it's like, oh man, I sure hope this isn't foreshadowing a great mm-hmm. betrayal or something from these people that Buck trusts so much and puts himself on the line for. That would be awful.
If this was 2019, I'd make a Fast and Furious joke, but it's not, so I won't.
Okay.
But so Buck storms out of Chase, the ambulance chaser's office, and then we go to this scene of this mom is in this car. She's driving this car with her two mm-hmm. young sons in the back seat. The older son is antagonizing the younger son. The younger son is complaining about it to mom. It's one of those like a family, like domestic, like vehicle situations where it's just like mm-hmm. the kids are unruly. They're fighting each other and you have to keep your eyes on the road, but you have to kind of break up the fight too. Like, this is not an enviable situation to be in.
And also, to be clear, the mom is driving on like the windingest, scariest mm-hmm. mountain road, like the most precarious mountain road ever.
The terrain is a factor. Yeah. No guardrails anywhere. And you see like her like start to like go over like some of like the lines on the road as she's like, you know, her attention is split. So the fight escalates. It's turning like a little like physical, like the kids are like slapping each other and whatnot. And so the mom tries to like physically like break it up, like push like, you know, the kids away from each other. And she takes her eyes off the road and she almost like gets into a head on collision with like a Tonka truck. Just like one of those like nightmare like scenarios.
Big semi truck
swerves off the road at you know just the right moment. Thank God, and comes to rest on a little cliff, like a little mm-hmm. a little patch of
on the shoulder,
you know,
basically
on the shoulder. Yeah, and they like breathe. They're like, oh my God, and the kids start making fun of mom. They're like, you were so scared.
Yeah, like you should have seen your face. The kids are now united in making fun of mom. And at first the mom's like, that's not funny.
And she finds a little humor in it.
But yeah, all three of them start laughing. It's kind of cute.
And then the ground falls out from under them.
Yeah, unfortunately for them, their mirth is short-lived because the road gives way. We cut to the 911 call and the kid is whispering. He's like, you know, I need you to send someone. My car's on the cliff. And the person is like, it's not Maddie. But if it was Maddie, she would say, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. But the person's like, can you speak up? And he says, like, no, like, I don't want to move. I don't want to be too loud, because he's worried that the mountain will give way more. And we see their car, and it's basically like vertical halfway down this cliff. Like, it's barely hanging on.
Oh my God. So I'm like deathly afraid of heights.
And yet you're okay with roller coasters?
Yeah, because that's controlled stimulus, Jane. But this is like an absolute like worst case scenario for me, like a nightmare. Like the only way this could be worse is if there was like a spider in the car or something, you know? Like this, like mom's unconscious in the front seat. We're hanging over, like dangling over this like cliff that's like certain death if like the car
they
shifts.
Should have upped the stakes a little by also having a venomous tarantula in the car.
Yeah, that would have completed it, like where like I just straight up would have stopped watching the episode. And so the 118 responds, of course, and it's just like, Jesus Christ, how are we going to do this? And obviously the answer is we have to get them out of the car before the car falls, which it inevitably will. And so they get there, they set up their gear, and Chim gets to rappel down. A nice little inversion of a scene from season one, episode three. Hello, flashback.
I noticed that Bobby specifically asks Eddie to be on winch, and I was like, wow, congrats, Chimney. You're not the winch boy anymore.
He's moving up in the world.
Like, Eddie's our new proby, I guess.
And so it's going to be Chimney and Bosco rappelling down, and they get down. Chimney, like, he checks on the kids and all that. They're freaked out, and he takes he checks the pulse of the mom, and it turns out she's still alive. Her pulse is steady. She's just, you know, out cold. Right. Yeah. So they attach little winches to like the car itself. Bosco, has like a sweet moment with the kids where she's like, hi guys, what's your name? I'm Bosco. They're like, I'm Camden. It's not Camden. No, it is Camden.
I don't think it matters that much what the kids' names are, to be honest.
They're the ones in danger. I gotta care about them. But it's all Camden and Jesse, right? And the minute like they start to like, you know, comfort them and say like, oh, you know, we're gonna get you guys out of here, the car starts to fucking fall. The ground starts to give way more, and shit is about to get real. Right.
Yeah. Up on the road, Bobby realizes that the ground is just too soft, like things are still giving way. So he has them like move all the ambulances, move all the unnecessary weight away from this cliffside.
The way this call was juxtaposed with like the previous scene, I did see an undercurrent of like a critique of like the city like zoning office or something, where like this road was constructed on such like uninforced like rock that like a car on the shoulder or like, you know, whatever will just like tumble to its doom, right? And so maybe it's like, oh, the city should have, you know, blah de blah de blah. It's reinforcing Buck's ultimate decision in this episode. I don't know. Like, I'm not saying that as like a serious critique of like the city of LA or anything, but I just thought it was funny to juxtapose this call with that scene.
You're just like seeing little violations everywhere now. Yeah. Things you could sue them over.
It's like, oh wow, this is a lawsuit.
But down in the car, the brothers are finally getting along now that they're facing death. And I think they like get the younger brother out, and then the older kid is like, I don't want to leave until you get my mom. So they rescue the mom. And I noticed they don't cut away from the kid's face while Chimney is rescuing the mom. Like, we just hear it happening, which kind of makes it feel like they just didn't want to go to the trouble of shooting it. Shooting them, getting the mom out of the car vertically and like getting her onto this basket. It seems like they kind of were just cutting corners there. So that's funny. They get the older brother and they cut the car loose. We see it like tumble down the cliff and everybody's safe. Like, it worked out. Hen is with the mom, who starts to wake up. She's like, are my kids okay? And she looks over and the brothers are like supporting each other. And she says they're taking care of each other. And we see, oh, like, Hen got a look at some a successful sibling story.
Can I just say, and I think I've said this before, like, in a scenario that was, like, frighteningly similar to this, but I hate L.A. I hate, like, the environment of, like, the L.A. desert. I just think it's so, like, ugly and uninteresting. So whenever they do a call like this out in the hills...
Yeah, you said that in the... You said that in the bouncy castle call.
And the bouncy castle call. Yeah, so it's like, I stand by it. I don't know what it is. I just like, the mountains aren't impressive enough to be mountains for me. And damn. Then like the desert itself, it's just like so arid and dry that I'm just like, oh my God, why would you ever set anything out here? What even goes on out here? You know, like,
man.
Sorry. No shade to all of our listeners and, you know, Southern California or other desertous
but Ryan hates regions. You and the place but, that you live.
Right, I do. And I, you know, if you come to me by saying, like, do you stand by that? I will just say to your face, yeah.
And there you have it, folks. We go to Athena at home. She is looking into this abusive husband situation for Maddie. Mm-hmm. She's like, looked up the guy, but he doesn't have any violent crimes in, like, on his record, which I think Maddie was hoping that there was some kind of justification they could get for looking into him further, but there kind of isn't. So she's like, mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Athena. And then we see that she is calling Athena from outside the couple's house. She's like staking it out. Girl, you can't be doing this. Like, this is when we see her start to take it too far, essentially.
And like the guy rolls up, right?
Blasting music, like a real douchebag.
No, blasting specifically death metal. And that felt like such a TV thing to me because like, of course, right. Like they'll make like the abusive husband listen to death metal. He's a scary guy. Meanwhile, every metalhead I've ever met has been like the nicest guy in the entire world. And so like, right. And so like, I was just like, wow, this is such a TV moment. Like, of course, this the scary bad boy not bad boy and no, let me take that again. Of course the scary abusive husband will listen to death metal on your TV show. Like, get out of here. What bands?
Yeah, it would honestly be more realistic if he were listening to like Mumford and Sons or Imagine Dragons or something.
Yeah, you know,
Radiohead. No offense to any of those bands, I'm just saying.
We find out the guy's really into Radiohead. Like, oh my God, what a scathing indictment of that fan base.
I'm just saying, like, there are good people into Radiohead, but it's like I could see more of like a guy like this just having kind of normie taste. And okay, I'm not saying Radiohead is normie taste. I was talking more about the Mumford and Sons. Let me just try to offend as many music fans as I can. He's blasting music is all we're trying to say. And Maddie like pulls up the hood of her hoodie, which I thought was funny. It's like she's in a Lifetime movie or something. Likely thing for her to be doing. And mm-hmm. We cut away from that to Bobby and Athena at home. Bobby's cooking. Athena comes up and says, in a great Angela Bassett delivery, she says, mm-hmm. Do I smell candied yams? Like, she doesn't really say it. She doesn't really say it like a question. Like, do I smell candied yams? She says, do I smell candied yams? Like, it's an exclamation. Yeah. I loved that. So I was like, great acting choice, Angela Bassett. We hear that Athena has invited Buck over, which makes Bobby mm-hmm. nervous. Like, she didn't really ask him if she could invite him over. And he mentions to Athena that he hasn't told Buck something yet. We don't know what at this point, but he says, like, I didn't tell him yet. So mm-hmm. then there's, you know, the doorbell rings. Buck is here. Athena says pointedly, I'll get the wine. Good thinking, Athena. You're gonna need it, girl.
You're gonna need it. We cut to them eating. You know, Buck says, like, you know, I missed your cooking cap. And Bobby goes, like, he's like, you can tell he's uncomfortable. He's uh-huh. like, yeah, I missed your eating. We never have any leftovers.
This is like, oh my God. This is like when you give a dog, like a really good meal day. Right before you put it down.
It's just like
they're like, yeah, we'll feed him a steak because, you know, we're taking him to the vet later.
Athena offers him some collard greens and he says, you know, he can't have that because too much vitamin K is bad for his system since he's on blood thinners. And Bobby takes that as his cue to basically sort of rip the Band-Aid off, right? Buck, you know, he's going off about, you know, once I get off these blood thinners, all these dumbasses mm-hmm. will see that, you know, I'm fit for duty. And Bobby goes, I'm the dumbass. Fuck, I'm the dumbest. I'm the guy that's holding you back. And of course, yeah. the immense betrayal.
Well, it should be said that right before this, Buck was also like going on and on about how much he defended the LAFD to the lawyer, right? And like, wow, can you believe like how evil that guy was for wanting to do this to my friends and family on the LAFD? Like, I love you guys, so I defended you. So it's really like this painful moment, you know. Buck gets this like cartoonish look of betrayal on his face, and he's so like, as we've said, we think he's like justified for the way he's feeling in these episodes, but this stage of Buck is kind of emotionally immature, so he immediately goes, I thought you were my friend, in a way that feels so like, you know, he's not going to have a conversation about it. He's just like, you betrayed me.
He gets so angry about it. Like, you know, Bobby's trying to reason with him. He starts literally pounding the table out of like anger. Like, it's like, I don't want to call it a temper tantrum, because that feels like minimizing, but like what leads you to minimize? Like, and so he's sort of breaking down. And in that moment,
we get like the best drama queen Buck moment of the entire episode, which is Bobby is saying like, you know, I know you just went through the tsunami and maybe you feel like you can survive anything. And Buck says, great delivery. He's like, anything, like a knife in my back. I just wrote in my notes, like, this dramatic, messy bitch. I love him.
Love him so much. And so he very politely excuses himself from dinner. It's like one of those like those moments of like, you know, there's no positive outcome here. I'm just going to excuse myself.
You say politely, but he's still being a dramatic, messy bitch, because it's so clear. He's so clearly being like, fuck you guys, I'm leaving. But he's couching it in like, thank you for dinner, Athena. I've got to go.
And mom and dad over here are like, you know, they do like a great sort of like ad-libbed moment of like them like telling Buck he doesn't have to go. I actually thought Angela's like delivery in this moment was very raw.
Yeah, very natural. Although
very natural.
I feel like it's kind of one of those things you say just as a formality. It's like, what were you going to say or do if he actually did decide to stay, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, now let's all go watch a movie together as a family after I just knifed you in the back.
It's probably better for everybody that Buck stormed out.
Yeah. And he does storm out, and then that's dinner. That's that.
That's dinner. What a successful dinner at Bobby and Athena's house.
My goodness.
And we go right back to Maddie outside the couple's house. She's still staked out there. She hears them arguing. And I had a thought here, which is, I must say, the show makes it out like Maddie is crazy for doing this, which she kind of is. Mm-hmm. But let's be real. This is the type of thing they would have Athena do and then be totally vindicated.
Oh, 100%. Because you hear it starting to get like a little bit violent, like glasses shattering. There, you know, he's basically screaming at her.
Like, Athena kind of does do this at the end of season 7, and like it kind of goes totally unquestioned by the show.
She would have been, Maddie would have been justified in like making like an anonymous 911 call at this point, and like sort of skedaddling, or like maybe like lingering to like watch things happen from a distance. But like that is kind of where you think it would go. But instead, abusive man charges out of the house in a huff, right?
Yeah, maybe he's like gonna go for a drive to clear his head, and he like drops his keys and bends down in the middle of the road to pick them up. And Maddie fucking Buckley, she starts revving the car and almost runs him over with her car. She like swerves at the last second. Again, loved the drama of this. This is the, like, I'm realizing talking about it, like, what a dramatic episode. I was just loving all of this.
She could have had a body count of 3. She could have had a body count of 3. But, you know, like, as much as like emotionally that's like what we want to happen, because it's clear this man is abusing his wife. She would have gone to prison.
That would not
have
been good for Maddie.
She would have, you know, especially Athena would have been like, "Well, the law's the law. We're taking you to jail."
Although, hey, no body, no crime. Just bury that guy. And then, you know, they think I did it, but they just can't prove it.
I was thinking a little bit more like a Dixie Chicks Goodbye Earl, like those black eyed peas, you know, you're feeling weak, why don't you lay down to sleep, Earl? Well, ain't it dark wrapped up in that tarp, Earl?
I guess, hey, it's just kind of a country music tradition to be like, I killed my husband tonight. Mm-hmm.
Appalachian murder ballads. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah,
she
exactly.
could have done that.
Yeah, she could have, but you know, she's too morally pure, she doesn't do it. And she drives away.
I don't know if morally pure is the right idea. She's
okay. She's you can't even hit a guy with your car anymore because of woke.
Because of woke.
She's too straight laced and buttoned up.
But it is like a moment for her character because she was about to do it. Like, goddamn.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, mm-hmm. in all seriousness, like you see that this situation has really triggered her. Clearly, to go back to the theme of the episode, this yeah. is kind of a major emotional thing if it's getting her to the point where she almost murdered someone. Mm-hmm. But we see Buck meeting up with Chase the ambulance chaser again, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. now he's talking to him about suing for his sake so that he can get his job back. He clarifies, he's like, I just want my job back. He's not mm-hmm. trying to really hurt the LAFD. He just feels like he's being treated unfairly.
He doesn't want money.
And mm-hmm. you know, here we go into the lawsuit storyline. And I think we either got a comment on the podcast or like maybe I got a comment on my 911 video at some point from somebody saying that like from a legal perspective, they thought that this was basically justified. And I have to mm-hmm. kind of agree. I think, yeah. you know, I'm sure there are like the show really sets it up later to make it look like Buck did a really mean thing by trying to sue. And yeah, it is like a rather drastic measure to take, but it does also kind of feel like Bobby is treating him differently because he has this personal relationship with him. Like, it's true yeah. that Buck probably needs a little more time before going back to work, but it seems like, I think we heard Athena say something about this in like a couple episodes ago about like, are you really actually thinking he's not ready, or are you just kind of like holding him back because like you care about him too much or whatever? And it kind of does feel like Bobby's not just objectively looking at the situation and making a call.
Well, speaking to like the terms of the case, I mean, it does seem pretty airtight, like, you know, like in the sense that like you actually like, I mean, Buck got an open admission from his boss that he's the one deliberately keeping him from returning to work. Mm-hmm. And like, I think the only reason it sort of like flips narratively is because, you know, during the discovery process, you know, Buck ends up airing everyone's tea, right? Mm-hmm. In order to aid in the case, which honestly, like, I feel like was pretty immaterial in hindsight, you know, like,
I know it's like it's a necessary evil of legal proceedings, and like it sucked in the moment, but it's also like you said, immaterial. It kind of doesn't really have anything to do with whether the case was valid or not.
Yeah, and the case seems to be pretty valid. I mean, I feel like, you know, Buck is within his rights as an adult who has a career
right.
to sue for wrongful termination if, you know, he passed all of his, like, his medical exams, he passed his physical exams, and he's ready to get back out there. I mean, I'm sure Buck, mm-hmm. like, Bobby would have, like, a case to, I guess, counter sue or something like that,
right.
given like the incident at the house party, his welcome back party,
mm-hmm.
as like a justification for it. But like, I feel like Buck's case is kind of airtight here in terms of like every like, you know, metric that the department would consider, you know?
Yeah. And like within the story, we understand that, yes, Buck is like a reckless person and he is probably just making this rash decision. But just like kind of objectively, it seems like it never seems that unjustified for him to do this. But anyhow, he's entering his social network era, his suing his best friend era.
I think it does seem like kind of unjustified on one front, which is that, like, you know, Buck is being kind of short-sighted about this and he's not taking into mm-hmm. account the ramifications that winning this lawsuit would have on Bobby's career. Because I feel like this mm. would, if he won this lawsuit and was reinstated, some of the higher ups would look down on Bobby with a lot of scrutiny and he could be penalized
yeah,
as a leader.
Potentially.
You know,
and it's also just short-sighted in the sense that he's not considering that, again, it's like he no. and Bobby really needed to have a more in-depth conversation about truly yeah. what the terms of him returning are, because it yeah. still seems not 100% clear between the two of them, like whether Buck can ever come back or whether mm-hmm. Bobby just wants him to take a little more time off, because that seems yeah. like a major point of miscommunication. Mm-hmm. And maybe if that had been clarified, maybe we could have avoided all of this, because Buck is kind of emotionally immature, like I said, so he might just kind of take these things at face value. But if someone were to just explain it to him in a way that was better for him to be able to understand, maybe this mm-hmm. wouldn't have happened.
And so again, I have to put the blame on Bobby here. You know, like I don't want to treat Bobby like he's infallible or like, you know, like doesn't like deserve any of the blame here. I feel like that's like kind of like an easy position to jump to, especially like within the fandom, because we see Bobby as dad. We see Bobby as always acting in everyone's best interest. That's how the show often presents him. And I feel like Bobby was like, you know, the one who was really acting like sort of short-sightedly here. And acting from somewhat selfish motivations, you know, and without taking into consideration the harm that he was doing to Buck by not allowing him to return to work. So I do, I, as much as it does suck, I do kind of have to side with Buck here, even though I think it's a shitty thing to do. But then
it's like
you
a shitty situation, but that doesn't necessarily mean Buck is in the wrong.
Yeah, it's good drama, and like I feel like that's what makes the lawsuit storyline so frustrating to me, is because it's supposed to be frustrating, so it's actually good storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, you know? It's kind of hard to rewatch, but yeah, it is. It is a compelling storyline. So Chase starts warning him about the potential consequences of doing this. He's like, you know, if you lose, you might get kind of blacklisted from the LAFD. But Buck sees the potential benefits of winning as outweighing that.
Well, not just the LAFD. Like he says, like, you know, if you become like a litigious liability and you're known as that, then I don't think any firehouse in the country is gonna want to hire you. You know?
Yeah.
And so it's like a very high risk game that he's playing, this gambit.
Yeah, but Buck is like, if I win, I get my job back, and that's like the one thing that matters to him right now. So the lawyer's like, okay, we can do this. But he also mentions to him that he can't have any contact with the 118 while the proceedings are happening. And Buck kind of considers it. And he's like, whatever, I can do that because, quote, I'm alone in this fight. Cut to Eddie, which could mean nothing.
Which could mean nothing. Yes, Eddie is boxing. He's hitting a punching bag. Lena's holding it back because she's now his work wife. And she
R.I.P. Buck.
Like when he lets his guard down, she slaps him in the face.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I love her. I love Lena. She's like, I will acknowledge, especially on my rewatch, I'm like, yeah, Ronda Rousey's kind of a wooden actor, but I think like the writing of Lena totally checks out.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, they're basically talking about how Eddie is getting frustrated at like the lack of progress in Chris's therapy. He's really confused. He doesn't know how to help his son. Lena tells him that like she's been to therapy once after her dad died. Lore drop. Lena has a dead dad. might feed into why she was so concerned over her captain. I don't know. It's character drama for a character that the show doesn't really dwell on.
Yeah.
You know, good characterization. They basically like during her first therapy session, she allegedly made her therapist cry, and then she told her mom she didn't want to go back. Presumably
which is crazy,
because
but she
like
says
her therapist was weak, you know.
Yeah, we're getting the sense that Lena is a tough lady and always has been. And she says though that when her dad died, what finally helped her open up was when her mom opened up to her about how she was feeling and like made her feel like they were in this together. So I wrote in my notes again, Ronda Rousey's acting is a little wooden, but the advice is solid because yes, I think this is good advice for Eddie to have him try and open up to Christopher first.
I need Eddie to go to therapy. Like that should be how season 9 opens, is Eddie goes to therapy.
I mean, he has been to therapy in the show.
But he needs to have a therapy arc, you know.
And he needs like a better therapist, I think, for one thing.
Imagine if Eddie going to therapy and like actually like sorting through the mess that is his character became kind of a focal point for him. Kind of like almost like a Sopranos style framing device. Because you know, the whole like the premise of that show is that it's like the mob boss goes to therapy. No, I know. But like but like that like allows for such like interesting like character drama and also like a great sort of like character study in this like very damaged, like fucked up person, you know. And I mean, what is Eddie if
Eddie
not
is,
like a damaged
Eddie
fucked
is
up
just
person?
As fucked up as Tony Soprano.
Tony Soprano. I agree.
I'm always saying this.
I co-sign that.
But yeah, you know, ABC, think about that. Think about going for a more Sopranos vibe in season 9 of 9-1-1. I was just saying, you know, we want like something fresh to open up season 9. And I think that would be a real winner. Yeah. But we cut to these two iconic sisters. You know, we get another like 911 call cold open. We've got these two adult sisters talking about getting rid of their mom, their late mom's stuff. They are immediately they're like calling each other's bitches. They really are getting into it. And they're trying to like divvy up their dead mom's things and they're fighting over it. They one of them thinks that the other was always favored and got the stuff. Fun fact, these two sisters are played by real life sisters, Jolie Fisher and Trisha Lee Fisher, half sisters of Carrie Fisher. If anyone was wondering.
Really? Yep. I did not know that. Okay, well, fabulous. I guess that explains like how like lived in their relationship feels. Because I was totally buying this, you know?
So like one of them, they start arguing about like mom's ring. Like you got to keep mom's heirloom ring because you were her favorite, even though it should have gone to me. And one of them talks about, like, I even got mom this blender. And she starts making margaritas in a blender.
Margaritaville by Jimmy Buffett is playing. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So subtle.
It's so good. It's so good.
One sister starts, like, blending to drown the other out, which is great. She'll, like, try to talk and she starts up the blender again.
And they sort of come to, like, that sort of tentative sibling piece where, like, even in a fight, you can, like, come around to the other's perspective, like, for an armistice or something. And they have a drink and they have, like, five more.
Yeah, we cut to, like, five empty margarita glasses on, like, the poolside table. Mm-hmm. And the sisters are kind of dozing off. And once the sister with the ring has fallen asleep, the other sister, like, takes the ring and puts it on. And then also falls asleep. Cut to the 911 call. Help! It's stuck! I can't get it off. You guys, the ring got stuck. It got stuck on her hand.
It got stuck.
This is crazy. Her hand has, like, got all swollen up and blistered. And the ring is now, like, choking her finger. The 118 rolls up.
Yeah, the 118 rolls up. And, like... And Chimney, I guess maybe he had experience like seeing this when he was working as like a busboy in that karaoke bar, but
he
immediately notices that like, okay, they were drinking margaritas. This is a condition known as phytophotodermatitis or a margarita burn.
I would never have known this was a thing if not for this show.
It's a, it's something that apparently happens when lime juice or citrusy fruit like that makes contact with the skin and is then exposed to sunlight. I don't know if like there was anything in the ring itself that may have aggravated the condition, but like her hands are swelling. She's got boils and blisters everywhere and her finger is turning like all sorts of blue.
I had never heard of this happening to skin, but it does kind of make sense because there's like a classic like home DIY hair bleaching method where you put lemon juice on your hair and then go out in the sun and it bleaches it a little. Probably very, very bad for your hair health. But I was sort of aware of that.
Fun fact, that's what Sam did in season 2 of Glee when he confesses to Quinn on date that he dyed his hair with lemon juice because he wanted to look like Swayze in Point Break.
Yeah, it is a thing. I remember hearing about that as a kid. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was thinking in this scene, this goes to show like what they're missing by not having Buck on the team, because Buck, who was a bartender in Peru, definitely would have seen this before. Would have been like, I know exactly what's going on. But I guess Chimney did anyway. But I'm just saying, if Buck was there, he probably would have been the one to share that information.
Agreed. He could have agreed and been like, oh my god, I saw this as a bartender in Peru.
Yeah, and then we get some Buck lore. But they determine they're going to have to cut off the ring. And the sisters both get really upset. They're like, no, you know, that's our heirloom. And the one sister in particular seems really kind of stressed about this, and she, right as they're about to cut it off, she's like, wait, I sold the ring, you know, I sold it and I've already gotten paid for it. And the other sister is like, I can't believe you, that's an heirloom, how could you do that? But Hen is like, you guys need to get along, you're sisters. And they clock her as an only child. They're like, oh, you must be an only child to say something as stupid as that.
There's a great line that I want to call attention to because it genuinely made me like laugh out loud. I chortled at it. I did. Which is, you know, she's trying to like reason with Hen before she cuts it off. And Hen says, you know, your sister's finger is turning blue. That's the stage before it turns black and dead and falls off. Mm-hmm. And she says, that sounds horrible. Can't you just cut the finger off now before that happens?
Yeah. So funny. So funny.
My God. The bargaining doesn't work. Hen, naive as she is, cuts it off and gets it
off. The ring, not the finger.
No. Yes, the ring. And she then cuts the ring in half, gives one half to each sister, and tells them, sharing is caring.
That'll definitely fix their relationship.
And then, like, the call, like, ends there, because obviously it's resolved, but then we get, like, one of the most, like, on-the-nose needle drops. In a show filled with on-the-nose needle drops, we cut to Maddie at a gym, and what is blaring over the speakers but I Hate Myself for Loving You by Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. she is stalking the victim of this horrible man at a gym, right, where she is a trainer. Her name is Tara, and... Mm-hmm. Maddie gets her attention by, like, futzing with the machine and asking her if she knows how it works. And Tara's like, yeah, I'm a trainer.
I love, mm-hmm. May I just say, I love that as part of Maddie's dastardly plan, she's actually going to start going to the gym.
she got a membership. Like, I don't think she went to this gym before. So she filled out all the paperwork. She's like, it's like a, oh, this is time I got into Planet Fitness or whatever.
Yeah. But Maddie asks this woman, like, oh, you're a trainer. I had no idea. She's like, do you have any openings? And mm-hmm. Tara says, well, yeah, I happen to be open right now. Like, and the first session's free. So Maddie presumably does a whole session with her. And then we see them coming out of the gym.
Okay, this is the crazy part. She does a whole session with her. Like, this is, like,
that's
this
what I'm saying. Like, it's so funny to me that she's going to these lengths. She did, like, she's just gonna start going to the gym and training, mm-hmm. like, just to get to know this woman and try mm-hmm. and infiltrate her way. It's very Lifetime, very, very Lifetime. Tara's like, so are we on again for next Thursday night? Which mm-hmm. I thought was funny, because that's the show, like, subliminally telling us to tune into 911 on Thursday night.
Oh, that's funny.
But Maddie lies to Tara that she's a nurse. And then Tara's husband shows up. His name is Vincent. And he meets Maddie. You know, we see Maddie get triggered by this, you could say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she just introduces herself and lets them drive away.
And then Tara says, we're going to get stronger together. Right, Maddie? And, like, that's a sweet line. I like that line.
Yeah,
it's got some themes in there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she lets them drive away, and her master plan is all coming together.
It's all right? coming together. The perfect
she's made
crime.
Contact. The perfect crime.
We see her coming into work the next day, where mm-hmm. she finds Chimney waiting for her, like, in the break room, and he says he wanted to talk about what happened on their date, because I guess they haven't managed to talk about it yet. We actually saw in the previous scene Maddie, like, turning down a call from Chimney. So presumably maybe she's even been kind of avoiding him. And Chim mm-hmm. says that at the Cliff call he responded to earlier in the week, he saw the brothers being strong for each other and the older brother trying to be strong for the mom. And it triggered all these emotions in him about mm-hmm. his situation with his mother, who was dying of cancer when he was a kid, and how he wanted to be strong for her. And so Chimney says, like, he understands that Maddie was triggered and he empathizes, which, what wonderful, like, emotionally mature communication, like, finding a way to connect and, like, mm-hmm. understanding, empathizing with what she's going through. He's so great.
If only Bobby and Buck had this sort of clarity. But then again, I guess they're not sleeping together, so maybe that's a little different.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Chimney mentions, you know, as he's describing, like, sort of the sympathy he has for it, he talks about, you know, how he had to be there for Albert, you know, he had to be strong for his little brother in the wake of his mom's cancer diagnosis and all that.
I don't think he was saying, though, because he didn't grow up with Albert. Albert was his dad's kid after he moved back to Korea.
Well, then who was his little brother that he had to be strong for? Was it Kevin?
I had that thought, too, but I don't think he was actually saying that he literally had to look after his mom and brother. I think he was just saying the kid looking after his mom and brother reminded him of looking after his mom, being strong for his mom. But also maybe the show was just kind of getting messy and forgetting what was what, because I don't think it would make sense for it to be Albert or Kevin. Chimney is like, you know, I don't want there to be any more hiding between us. And Maddie agrees. She's like, no more hiding. But you get that there's a little bit of irony in her saying that, because she is currently stalking someone and no one knows this.
And no one
but knows. We cut to other healthy couple, Hen and Karen. They're in bed. Karen is asleep. Hen's kind of watching over her. And a little timer goes off. And Hen has to wake Karen up because it's time to get an injection for her IVF treatment.
Karen says, you could flirt with a girl before you knock her up.
Yeah, great joke. Great lesbians doing IVF joke. And Karen is like confirms with her that they still want this. I think she probably sensed Hen's anxieties about Denny. I almost said Eddie.
Oh my god,
about
Eddie.
Denny having a sibling.
What if Eddie gets a sibling? Eddie. Eddie's sisters make their dramatic debut 8 seasons in.
Wouldn't that be great? Anyway, she, you know, Karen presumably sensed Hen's anxieties about Denny wanting siblings, and she wants to confirm that they both still want this. But Hen says, actually, she's realized she was really lonely as a kid after her dad left, and she doesn't want Denny to feel that way. She wants him to have companionship. And even if he doesn't like it at first, like, there will be great times together, and they'll come to love each other and have each other's back. So that's a nice moment. Like, thread wrapped up, you know?
Yeah, and it's sweet. And then we go from that sweet scene to another very sweet scene where Eddie is putting Christopher to bed, and he says, let's tuck these feces in. I'm like, He like checks like to Chris's like pearly whites and everything. He's like, it's like the meme from iCarly, like,
His teeth are just too bright.
Too bright.
He's doing a very sweet, you know, bedtime ritual, and he's like, good night. He's walking out of the room, and he sees like a drawing of Christopher's posted on the wall. And it's like a picture of their family, right? It's a drawing of Christopher, Eddie, and Shannon. And Eddie, like, has this realization. He goes into the other room and finds one of Christopher's creepypasta woman drowning drawings. And he notices that the two women look the same. So he goes over to Christopher. He's like, is this mom? Is the woman you're seeing drowning in your dreams your mom? This is like, I'm sorry, this is so weird.
It's really weird, and it's like sad, it's kind of weird, and it's like kind of, it's kind of upsetting, and it's like,
it just feels kind of like out of left field for like this show and like what we've seen of these characters so far. I'm not saying like it doesn't not make sense for a grieving child to like his traumas to run together in the dreamscape.
It's nice that we have like an acknowledgement of Chris grieving Shannon, like that part is nice, but it's kind of ghoulish.
It's kind of ghoulish, and I think maybe the part that feels dissonant to me is that I don't really recall this going much of anywhere. Like, it's framed like this big dramatic reveal of like, oh my god, the woman in his dreams is Shannon, and then I feel like it doesn't really, like, we see Eddie have his anger management problems after, which is presumably partly to do with his stress with his son being traumatized, but I don't know if I'm describing this disconnect well, but it feels a little odd to me, like the way that this, I guess maybe you could attribute it to Eddie's general lack of coherence to his storylines that we get a lot of the time.
That's what I'm getting from this, because like we have a really great character moment where, you know, Eddie asks Chris, you know, why didn't you tell me you were feeling this way? And Chris says, because I didn't want to make you sad. And it's like, it's sweet, and it's also devastating. And like, you'd think this would inspire some sort of shift in Eddie.
But he just joins an underground fight club.
Yeah, not the shift you expect.
Another thing I found weird about this whole Eddie arc in this episode and going forward is we have that scene earlier where Lena tells him, you know, maybe you should open up to him first and then he'll open up to you. And then Eddie just doesn't do that. Like, that's not the way the storyline is resolved. And I found that really strange. I was like, why would they have her give him this good parenting advice and then he just doesn't take it? And then it's not mentioned again? 911, what's your emergency?
My mic cut out and we lost part of the recording.
Yeah, funny story, guys. It is 9:50 p.m., an hour later for Ryan, on Thursday the 5th, the night before we post this. And the one time I decided to wait until Thursday night to record, to edit an episode, It turns out Ryan's mic cut out for the last like 8 minutes, so we are hopping on the the mic again to finish up this episode.
We're having a normal one. I just want to say we're having a normal one. I'm downloading the new Mario Kart on my brand new Switch 2 that I just got. I paid a lot of money for it. Like a lot of money. So
subscribe to that Patreon, everybody, to feed Ryan's addictions.
But hey, since we are recording like the day before an episode goes up, for once we can talk about topical things.
Trump and Musk are breaking up.
Yeah, heartwarming. The two worst people you know are fighting.
so true. So we were just talking about Eddie and Christopher. Anyway, we're almost at the end of this scene, but the one more thing I wanted to bring up is I'm kind of obsessed with the way Eddie, he is talking about Shannon. He says, "I miss her too. I probably always will." And I was like, probably? You probably will always miss her?
I mean, I think that's probably such a crazy thing to say. You know, like, probably.
He's like, I might get over it, but, you know, right now I'm pretty sad about it.
Yeah, but, like, I'll be fine, you know? Like, don't you fret. Like, I'll, you know, I'll move on and I'll, you know, get intertwined with some dark interloper that looks exactly like her.
Right. Like, he doesn't even know how much he will continue to probably miss her over these next few seasons. But anyway, the scene ends with them saying they've still got each other, which means they're going to be okay. And it is a sweet scene, but like we said, kind of a weird culmination to this storyline at the same time.
Yes, definitely. And so that brings us right back into the denouement of the episode. Buck, always Buck, shows up to the blended Grant Nash household in the middle of the night, knocking on the door.
Bobby hears his doorbell ring late at night, and it's Buck. He says he wants to apologize for walking out on dinner, and, you know, Athena comes up. They invite him in, but he says he can't do that. In fact, this will be the last time they can talk for a while. Mm-hmm. Buck thought he should be the one to deliver the papers, because I'm suing the city, the department, and you. For wrongful termination.
Such a fucking drama
queen. He said, like a little brat bitch.
Literally. Like a bratty little brat ass bitch. Affectionate.
Yes.
He hand delivers the affidavit, essentially declaring war on Bobby Nash.
It's like they're getting divorced. It's like he's delivering divorce papers.
Like these divorce papers were written in blood, and so will be your signature. And
Buckby moment.
Buckby, so cursed. And leaves him looking absolutely like devastated. And Angela Bassett is just there in her like her little shawl like next to him, and it's like you hear like the war drums starting to pick up. It's like, oh, this is gonna be grisly.
Yes, like I've been saying this whole episode, I love the drama. I love the angst. Inject it straight into my veins. I just love how dramatic everyone in this episode has been. You know, that's my dramatic, messy bitch of a character.
Hello.
And I love it.
Hello. So with that, the episode comes to a close, leaving us on this wunderbar cliffhanger.
Yeah, this is so funny because we just recorded our next episode today.
So we know exactly how it goes.
It feels so weird to be doing this right now. But anyway, thank you for listening to this episode. I've got it fresh, hot off the presses for you. You know, subscribe to our Patreon if you want to fund. Well, I feel like it sounds bad if I say subscribe to our Patreon to fund Ryan buying video game consoles, but ideally to fund Ryan maybe getting a new microphone at some point that won't cut out.
Yes, the video game consoles are bought. None of the Patreon money went to a video game console. I want to say that was my paycheck at my waiter job. As a tax-paying
first
adult.
Podcasts are putting Patreon funds towards buying Switches,
as is our god-given right as Americans. Thank you. But the Patreon money, I will save it up so I can get a new microphone, because this is shitting out.
And subscribe if you want to hear us talk about The Boy Next Door, and potentially Gay Eddie, ooh, which is currently leading in the polls on our Patreon, like, topic suggestion poll. So that'll be exciting. The case for and against Gay Eddie, right in time for Pride Month.
Happy Pride, guys. You know, stay safe, use condoms, be careful with your poppers, don't drink them.
Always good advice. And, you know, everybody remember to always be at your most dramatic, your most messy, and your most petty at every turn in life. Because, you know, you only live once, so they say. And who knows how many opportunities you'll get to make an enemy out of your entire social and work circle. So, you know, seize the day.